So this hour goes to the mothers, the founding mothers of our country. Cokie Roberts of NPR fame wrote the book Founding Mothers, then a Young Readers Illustrated edition. We talked to Cokie Roberts almost exactly 3 years ago, so obviously we can't take any new phone calls or emails today.
The bold pictures of the founding of the United States, you know, like on the back of the money, show scenes like the signing of the Declaration of Independence. All those great men gathered in one place at one time, and not a woman in sight. Maybe women were invisible on an official power-wielding level at that time, but they had great influence just the same. While we tend to talk about the founding fathers, today's guest writes of the founding mothers. Her book by that name is a slender volume with many illustrations aimed at younger readers. Cokie Roberts is the author of Founding Mothers. Hers is one of the most recognizable voices on NPR after decades of work on the radio and on ABC News. Her credits and awards are too numerous to mention, and the Library of Congress named her a living legend in 2008. She's the author or co-author of several other books, including Founding Mothers, The Women Who Raised Our Nation, and Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. Cokie Roberts, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
So good to be with you, Jeff.
Was there always a plan to offer an illustrated version for younger readers?
Well, not when I wrote the original book. It came out in 2004, but very soon after it came out, the publisher asked me to do a children's book. So it's been 10 years in the making, and that's because, it turns out, who knew, that children's book illustrators, good ones, are really, really busy people. And getting Diane Good, who has done just fabulous, fabulous illustrations for this book, getting on her schedule took a long time. But thankfully, it finally happened, and these delightful illustrations are now a part of the record.
In the time between the publisher suggesting you do this book and then being able to finish it, were you notice anything from younger readers, grandkids maybe, who didn't know some of the names you were dealing with?
Oh, I mean, not just grandkids. Grown-ups don't know the names that we're dealing with. It's remarkable how little is known of the women who were so influential in this incredibly important period in our history. I mean, this is the period when we're becoming a country, right? Fighting off the British and writing the documents that are basically the foundation of our nationhood. And so the fact that these women are really unknown is in some ways shocking and in other ways not surprising at all.
Are these names that have been familiar to you for a very long time, though? Does your own
fascination? Well, I knew about Martha Washington and Abigail Adams and Dolly Madison, but but I didn't know about Eliza Pinckney, and I didn't know anything about Deborah Reed Franklin other than her name, and I didn't know Mercy Otis Warren, and I didn't know Esther DePert Reed. I mean, I didn't know a lot of these women.
Is there how hard is it then to follow paper trails back to learn about
really
them?
Hard. It is detective work. The fact is that people really didn't pay attention to women's writings in the 18th century. So they destroyed their own documents. So we believe that Martha Washington burned all of her correspondence with George Washington. So Mount Vernon has done a very good job of putting together whatever they have and a lot of stuff from other sources. But so some of the documents were just gone. Others were not well preserved. People just didn't think they were important. So the women's letters would be stuck with the men's letters someplace and just never really surfacing. And I'll tell you a funny story, Jeff. You know, here I am, a daily journalist for most of my life and used to filing on deadline sometimes several times a day. And I called one historic society that shall remain nameless, and I said, "You've got the papers of so-and-so. You know, do you have his wife's papers?" And they said, "Oh, we're nowhere near, you know, finishing his papers. We haven't even thought about hers." And I said, it's been 200 years.
That's a long deadline.
But to them, that's a wink of an eye.
Were some of these just impossible to flesh out then? Did you reach some real dead ends?
Yes, I mean, Martha Jefferson, for instance. You cannot write about Martha Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson supposedly destroyed all of their correspondence because he was heartbroken when she died. I don't personally think it's the way one acts when one is heartbroken, but it's his story and he's sticking to it. But the so you can't write about her. You can write about his daughters, and I have done that at length in Ladies of Liberty, the sequel to Founding Mothers. But there's no way that you could write about her.
Interesting. So in some respects, we actually know more about Sally Hemings than we do about Martha Jefferson.
Yes. I mean, well, we don't know what she wrote, and we don't know what she thought. And that's something that, when you think about it, is quite, you really, really would love to know, because it would explain a great deal about whether she was victimized or whether she loved him, or maybe both. And I would love to know the answer to that question.
Oh, that is one we won't get to know, it sounds
like.
No. So let's talk about the organization of the book. Eliza Lucas Pinckney, who you already mentioned, comes first. Why her first?
She's oldest.
Age before beauty.
That's really complicated. No, she was the mother of founders. So her sons, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney and Thomas Pinckney, were both in the Revolutionary War, both ended up fighting with Washington, and then served in government in a variety of posts, including helping write the Constitution in one case. And they were ambassadors and ran for vice president, and they were governors, and they were very influential men of the Revolutionary and New Republic periods. But she was fascinating. I mean, she was there. She was at age 16, having taken over three plantations in South Carolina, and you know, most of us these days are afraid to give the 16-year-olds the keys to the car, much less the deeds to the plantation.
Remember the Ladies by Cokie Roberts, up for discussion on the Exchange. We'll pick up the discussion in just a minute. On the Jefferson Exchange, on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Cokie Roberts, long a fixture at NPR, wrote several books about major women in American history, including a children's version called Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. She joined us several years ago, and we're hearing it again now. There are some listener calls from back then, but sorry, we can't take any new calls today.
Well, Cokie, it figures that Benjamin Franklin had a feisty and clever wife. Deborah Reed Franklin, though, it sounds like was kind of forced into the role a bit by Ben's activities.
To put it mildly.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, one of the things I learned in elementary school was that Benjamin Franklin was the first Postmaster General of the United States. But he wasn't in the colonies at the time. He was in England. He was the lobbyist for the colony of Pennsylvania before the British Parliament. And he stayed in London for 12 years with Deborah writing him constantly saying, come home, come home. And he refused to come home. Their only daughter got married, and he wrote saying, keep the wedding cheap. But still he wouldn't come home. And she was left to run everything. And she did a very good job of it. She was an excellent businesswoman. So she ran the postal service, and she hired special horses and horsemen and everything to get the mail delivered in a timely fashion. And at one point, the Englishman, the nobleman who was the titular head of the service, Lord Loudon, tried to fire one of her workers, who was, of course, a cousin. And she got furious and told off Lord Loudon in a letter that's one great fun to read. And that's really my favorite illustration in this book, is of Deborah Franklin looking just absolutely furious with a little tiny Lord Loudon in the palm of her hand.
It is a wonderful illustration.
It is. It's just great. But she ran the postal service. She ran the business, which they had printing businesses that were really kind of like Kinko's. They were franchises that went out to the frontier, which was Pittsburgh, and she ran all of those. And And Franklin was very grateful to her. He would say, you know, she does a great job. You know, good work, Deborah. Carry on. And at one point, his colleagues in Philadelphia felt that he was insufficiently ardent in his opposition to the Stamp Act as a lobbyist in London, and they threatened to raise his house. And she was warned to leave, that, you know, the house was going to be burned down, and she didn't. Instead, she got a gun, and she got some cousins with guns, and they warded off the attack. And again, that is also a wonderful illustration. But and she said, I've never given any offense to anyone, but if anybody wanted to do me harm, I was ready to take them on. And again, he said, great, Deborah, you know, well done. But he refused to come home, and finally she died. And he wrote to a friend that he had to go home because his wife, in whose hands I have placed the care of my affairs, has died. So poor Ben had to finally leave his fun and games in London and go home.
Now, after 17 years.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I will admit, once he got home, he did help write the Declaration of Independence. And then he went to France and helped forge the alliance that won the war. But still, he was very, very difficult to his wife and then his daughter.
I love the actual wording here. Things were so genteel in those times. Her statement, which you just referenced, I had not given offense to any person at all, but if anyone came to disturb me, I would show them proper resentment. Right next to a picture of her holding up a musket.
Right, and that's very illustrative, because the person who put that in was the illustrator, Diane Good. And she did a lot of, now that quotation was in the grown-up book, but still, she did a lot of research herself. She got very interested in how the women dressed, how they would get their clothes cleaned, all kinds of things. And she especially got interested in their handwriting and tried to imitate it, because she felt it was so artistic, and as an artist, she wanted to see how that worked. So her husband found for her the nibs for quill pens, antique ones. And so she would practice writing with ink and an antique pen and seeing how hard that was. And then Hurricane Sandy hit, and she lives in New Jersey, and she found herself without power for many, many days. So she really was connecting with these women.
Writing by candlelight or something?
Right, yeah. Exactly, and freezing. And then at the last minute, she was so interested in their handwriting that at the last minute she said to me, do you think we could get all of their signatures? And I said, wow, that's going to be hard because, you know, as I've said, these papers are not easy to come by. But I was able to track them all down. So under each woman's picture is, in fact, the way she actually signed her name. And I just find that very cool, the idea that all 10 of their signatures are there.
This is the work of the illustrator Diane Good in Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. Cokie Roberts, the author, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. And I must say about Diane Good's work, it's unlike anything I've ever seen before, in the sense that she seems to move seamlessly from the lines that you use when writing cursive writing and signatures into illustrations.
Well, she also, she kind of used the writing as the leitmotif, and so you see it on pretty much every page, but she also used materials in the illustrations that would have been around. So she used pastels, and she felt that was something that the women themselves could have used if they had wanted to illustrate something.
Let us take some calls. Here is Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Cokie Roberts, the author of Founding Mothers.
Ms. Roberts, thank you. Your objective reporting and your insightful analysis helped me form a greater understanding of how our polity works.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Ma'am, it's only the truth. Thank you. You're a brilliant reporter, and I'm looking forward, even as an adult, to reading these stories. I have a question in terms of how the influence and effect of women has evolved over the last 200 years. I know that's a huge question to ask, but Do you see real improvement in our political system as a result of the influence of women, or is it still pretty much business as usual and everybody's playing the same game?
All right. Thanks for the question, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think everybody's playing the same game. We're at a very difficult time in our politics, which everyone is well aware of. Nothing much is getting done because people are at swords points, but they're actually not at swords points. In the time that I was writing about, they were at swords points and at guns points. But they are very hostile to each other, and it's very difficult to get things done because of the polarization and the partisanship. But the one little island of bipartisanship in the Senate is among the women of the Senate, and there are 20 of them now, and they really do get together on a regular basis in order to try to get things done. I tease them that when they have these regular dinners with each other, that they just want to be in a testosterone-free zone. And they say that's true, but that they also really do accomplish things when they get together. And it's no accident that the last big bipartisan bill, which was the bill that got the government reopened and funded for the next couple of years, really came about as a result of the women of the Senate getting together and getting some colleagues to come along. But the women were the ones who were just saying, oh, for heaven's sakes, this is ridiculous, and making it happen. So I do think it makes a difference in the polity, and I think that it makes a difference in terms of policy. There are lots of issues, particularly issues that affect women and children and families, that women put at the top of their priority list. And it's not that men don't care about things like child care or breast cancer research or housing for single mothers or older women or those kinds of things. They do care, but they don't put it at the top of the priority list, and women do.
Cokie Roberts, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, longtime correspondent for NPR and ABC News, and the author of a book for younger readers called Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies, lavishly illustrated by Diane Good. When you were talking about that difference, though, in the way that the men and women in Congress tend to view things, I'm reminded of Dave Barry's line about the fact that a woman knows her child's blood type, height, weight, school schedule. Men are vaguely aware of small things being around the house. Is that the problem you're describing in Congress?
There's some short people wandering around, right?
Exactly.
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, attention to detail is paid.
Right. Let's take another call. Here's Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Cokie Roberts.
Well, good morning. Ms. Roberts, I'd like to hear your opinion on Mercy Otis Warren.
Right.
I believe she was the sister of James Otis of taxation representation fame.
Otis also was a very early supporter of women's rights. Unfortunately, he was completely crazy and eventually went crazy. I mean, totally. But he was a very interesting character in Massachusetts in the 1760s and 70s.
Wasn't she?
She was the wife of James Warren, and he. It's interesting about Mercy Otis Warren. She is one of the women in the children's book, one of the 10 women profiled, and she was very influential as a propagandist for the Revolution. She wrote poems and plays that attacked the British governor of Massachusetts, and the men. She kept up a steady correspondence with the influential men, and gave them her ideas, and also reported to them what the British were doing in Boston that helped galvanize the Continental Congress against the British. But so on the one hand, she was very, very influential in her own right. On the other hand, and I don't talk about this in the children's book because it's a little complicated, but she really couldn't manage the household and the business and everything on her own. And Warren was never in Philadelphia with the others, and he would have been if he had a wife like Abigail Adams, who was able to manage the farm and collect the legal fees and you know, keep the body and soul and family and finances together, as hard as it was. But Mercy couldn't do that, and it really did hold her husband back. But I think it's kind of the exception that proves the rule, because it shows you that the others really depended on their women to make things work for them so that they could go off and just think great thoughts in Philadelphia.
She was something like your predecessor in a sense. I mean, she wrote so much and was something of a reporter in addition to a propagandist.
Well, that's true. She was. And she did later write a huge history of the American Revolution. And it made her old friend John Adams mad, because by then they differed politically. But it's a very interesting history because it covers things. It's in the same way that we were talking about women in Congress being interested in some policy issues that the men are not as interested in. That's true in her history as well. She talks about things like rape during the war, which you don't read about in any of the men's histories.
Interesting. Let's go to take another call. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Cokie Roberts. She's the author of Founding Mothers.
Hi. First, let me say, Cokie, if I may say that. I used to watch you on television and listen to you on television years ago when I had television. And I always, something about you, I always found you believable. I couldn't tell you one thing you said. I just always found you believable.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Now I know why, just hearing you on the radio. I didn't ask my two questions. It was the first thing you addressed before you even knew the Marthas. And thank you. You just went right to that. And I wanted to add that the name Martha is Armenian for lady. How appropriate for your book.
Uh-huh. Well, good.
But, so you're talking about Martha?
I just finished reading again the Grand Dames. Can you imagine being named I'm a Hog?
Yes, right. There's a wonderful
lady
book about
Washington.
Her. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
All right. So Martha Washington certainly is mentioned in the book. And forgive those of us who are not aware of the fact that she was at Valley Forge in that freezing winter during the Revolutionary War.
Well, actually, that's the only thing I did know about her, was that she had spent that winter at Valley Forge. I mean, when I started on this project, I didn't know that she had spent all eight winters of the eight long years of the Revolutionary War at camp with the soldiers. And I didn't know why she was there. And it turned out that the reason that she had to go to camp every year was that George Washington asked her to come because he felt that she was absolutely essential to troop morale. You know, there were periods during the war when the troops were not getting paid, they weren't getting fed, they weren't getting housed, they weren't getting clothed, and they threatened desertion by regiment. No bread, no soldier. And the general, as she called George Washington, would beg her to come to camp every winter and with the other officers' wives to work with the soldiers and sew for the soldiers and nurse them and pray with them and put on entertainments for them. Lots of entertainments took place, even when in terrible conditions. And she really didn't like to go to camp. It was unpleasant. It was also scary. You had to go across very dangerous roads. She was a prime target for hostage taking. The British were taking patriot wives hostage, and she, of course, was the chief patriot's wife. And she also felt that she was always leaving duty behind at Mount Vernon. But over the summer, she would supervise the slaves, the enslaved persons at Mount Vernon, who would weave cloth and preserve foods and smoke meats. And then she would arrive at camp with a full carriage, just one of the many contributions of African Americans to the cause. And she would be cheered into camp. Lady Washington is here. And people were just thrilled to see her. The soldiers adored her. And that was an enormous contribution that she made. I must say, Jeff, it was a good thing she was on hand because George could be a little bit indiscreet. There was one of those dances where he danced for 3 hours straight with the very flirty and very pretty Katie Green. So it's just as well that Martha was on hand.
Oh, nice to have a little rudder for him to steer.
A little chaperone,
right. Exactly. there's a section here following Martha Washington, though, about women warriors. There actually was a woman soldier during the Revolution?
There were probably quite a few. There's one who became quite famous, Deborah Sampson, who dressed as a man, took the name Robert Shurtleff, and went to war. And she volunteered for all kinds of dangerous assignments, and she was injured several times, but she kept volunteering. And finally, she got sick and had to go to the camp hospital. And the doctor, of course, discovered her secret. But she got a congressional pension, which is one of the ways we learn about these women.
Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies is the discussion topic with its author, NPR's Cokie Roberts. We'll pick up the discussion when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Cokie Roberts, yep, that Cokie Roberts, joined us almost exactly 3 years ago to talk about her book on notable women at the birth of America. The version for kids is called Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. And here is the rest of the interview.
I want to make sure we don't gloss over Abigail Adams because it was her quote that becomes the subtitle. What was it she wrote to John about the new code of laws?
Well, Abigail Adams was militating for independence for a good year before the men in Philadelphia were willing to declare it. And finally, as it got to the point where it was clear that there would be founding a new country, she said, well, I guess we'll have to come up with a new code of laws. And when you do, remember the ladies, because all men would be tyrants if they could. John laughed at her, which was very unusual. He didn't normally do that. He normally took her advice very seriously. Her political information was invaluable to him. He had something of a political tin ear himself. But he just laughed at her and did the classic guy put down, which is was, oh, come on, you women really have all the power. So she was just left to fume.
Let's take another call here of Ernie in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Cokie Roberts, the author of Founding Mothers.
Good morning. You guys got the vote, or you women got the vote in 1920. What do you know about, and what do you think will happen with the ERA? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Equal Rights Amendment. Well, that seems like a long ago history.
It does seem like a long ago history, and I really don't think we're ever going to see an Equal Rights Amendment passed. But what's happened is a lot of case law since the 1970s, when there was such a push for the ERA, that does protect women much more than was the case at the time. The whole issue is whether women are a protected class as African Americans are, for instance, under the Constitution. And the ERA was designed to ensure that. It failed, as you know, and what has happened, though, is a lot of cases have come before the court where the discrimination has been ruled illegal. So I would very seriously doubt that it will come back. The modern generation of women don't even really know about it, and I think that where you are now is that we have many, many, many more women in positions of power where they can work against any kind of discrimination. I'm not saying discrimination is gone, but I certainly wouldn't say that. But I think that there are people in position to do something about it.
Let's see, it passed Congress and needed 38 states to get into the Constitution. And it got to 35, was it?
It kept getting right up to it. And mm-hmm. then it was extended in like 1978 or 9. for some more years to get ratified, and the ratification just never happened.
I remember the pushback on it, though. It's like, oh, my God, we'll all have to be in one bathroom in public
places. I know, you know, sort of like on an airplane.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I had to ask about the Founding Mothers, though, and whether some of the exploits of the women recounted here and in your other books were encouraged or tolerated because of the needs of the New Republic, much like Rosie the Riveter got into action during World War II, and whether the expectation was that once we got the big thing done, go back to the kitchen.
Well, certainly they were tolerated because of the needs, but it was also a different time, Jeff. You know, coming to America in the 17th and 18th centuries was not easy, and so this was everybody was expected to sort of row the boat together. And there was no ability for women to just go home and tend to the tatting. That was not true in that era. That became much truer in the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution and men going out to work and women staying home. But in the 17th and 18th centuries, that was really not the case. Women were expected to be busy, to be involved, to do what was needed of them. But I do basically agree with the premise that war does create needs that women fulfill, and that after wars there is a desire to send them back, but it doesn't usually happen to the same degree as before the war. So, for instance, after the Revolutionary War, there was a huge push for women's education, which happened. And I'm actually writing right now a book on how the Civil War changed the lives of women. And, you know, women who were at home, who were elite but influential women in Washington in the period before the Civil War, as a result of the war, became very purposeful and became activist. And Clara Barton, for instance, wrote that, you know, we've come to much farther than we ever would have come had there been no war. So I do think that the basic premise that you raise is a correct one.
We have an email here from Debbie in Talent. Speaking of education, she writes, I noticed your book meets Common Core state standards for schools. Do you have an opinion about the new standards? Do you think that schools could be doing something different to change how people who disagree with each other don't get past their divide to work together?
Well, I think that the Common Core is a set of suggestions. It's not a syllabus. And I think that the idea that kids should be reading more and reading both literary fiction and nonfiction is a good idea. I'm sorry that the core does not include history as one of its standard presentations, because I think history is very, very, very important for our children to learn. And I think that one of the ways that we bring people together is by learning our history and understanding the importance of that, and understanding how this idea that we call America was formed and how it does depend on people compromising and being willing to give some and take some, and how that's been true from the beginning. And I think that learning about that gives you a sense of why that is something to be valued. So I do think our history helps us with being better citizens today.
Do you think that the more people are surprised by stories like the ones you write about in Founding Mothers?
Absolutely. I was surprised. I was very surprised at how explicitly the women were called on to be political, to rise up against the British, to enforce the boycott, to replace the goods that were not coming in because of the boycott, to be daughters of liberty, all of that. That all surprised me. And then I was extremely surprised to read their mail and see how, you know, very, very political they were in their opinions, not just in writing to the men who they assumed would be interested in this, but in writing to each other. They clearly, this was part of the conversation.
I must admit that while there's a great deal of sadness about the fact that so many letters got burned, when I think about Martha Washington burning her letters, I have this image of, you know, Oliver North and Fawn Hall with the shredder, just in a very different context.
Well, in fact, I just learned just recently that Bess Truman did exactly the same thing, and Harry Truman came upon her burning her correspondence to him. And he said, Beth, what are you doing? Think of history. And she said, I am. That's why I'm doing this.
Speaking of history and the things we learn from it, though, or don't, perhaps. And I noticed that there's one story in here that does not appear, the story of Molly Pitcher, which I grew up with, you know, the woman who allegedly at the Battle of Monmouth picked up her
husband's... No, I think it was true. I think it's a true story. Mm-hmm. We're not exactly sure who she is. But there are women who were on the field in Monmouth at the time who fit the bill. We just did, you know, that kind of little interlude about women warriors, and the one I chose instead of Molly Pitcher was Margaret Corbin, because, again, we have the records. And Margaret Corbin was with her husband at the Battle of Fort Washington, and she was out watering the cannon, and he was killed. And she took over the gun. She was hit 3 times. The British then won. And Americans surrendered. And she was so badly injured that she couldn't fight again. But she received a congressional pension. So I know who she is. She's a real person with a real name and a real record. And she's buried at West Point. So when I have the choice of someone who may or may not be real and somebody who is real, I'll go with the real one.
That sounds like a fair option here. Is there any one person who impressed you more than anybody else in this book of all the people you learned about?
No, you know, I never am good about this in modern times either, about, you know, who's the most interesting, best interview, worst interview. I'm sure you get asked that all the time. And the answer, as you, I'm sure, also feel, is that people are so different from each other. You learn something from everybody, and these women are very different from each other. I think that the one who was probably the most fun to just hang out with was Sarah Livingston Jay. And I say that just because her letters are so utterly delightful that she just sounds like a lot of fun.
So to switch the context just a bit then, I mean, to go from historical to the current political, I mean, you've covered so many political figures over the years. Are there many, or any for that matter, who you thought really, really transcended their time, who would have been effective leaders at other points in American history?
Oh, I'm sure there are plenty. I'm not good at sort of singling people out, but there have been many people over the years that I've been impressed by. And then it's also true that when you look back on figures, they take on a different perspective. I mean, I think that, you know, the way that people saw Ronald Reagan when he was president is different from the way people see Ronald Reagan now. I know the way people saw Harry Truman when he was president is different from the way people see Harry Truman now. So I think that, you know, as history marches on, that we get a different sense of people who were in, even in our own lifetimes.
And we've already referenced the gridlock in Congress and the people at metaphorical sword points anyway. I mean, are the stakes truly higher, or just the players more determined and contentious?
Oh, the stakes are not higher. I mean, the stakes were unbelievably high at this period of time. You're talking about the formation of the country, and people were as partisan as they are now. And it was very, very dangerous because the country was too young and too fragile to be able to sustain it. And that's why, again, the women were so incredibly important. And the hero of the early republic, in my view, is Dolly Madison, because the partisanship was so great. I mean, they literally were shooting each other. You know, the Burr-Hamilton duel is just the most famous, but there were duels happening all the time. People would call each other out on the floor of the House of Representatives and go out to Bladensburg, which is just outside of Washington, where there was a dueling ground, and they'd shoot each other over political speech. And she would make them stop it, and she would make them all come together and come to her parties, her squeezes, as they were called, and break bread together and sip wine together and behave. And at one point, in fact, the Federalists tried to boycott her entertainments because they were being in a partisan smit, and realized they couldn't because they would be ignorant. They would be left out of all the political information and deal making if they didn't go to Dolly Madison's. And so she was a tremendous influence in keeping the country together at a time when the stakes were unbelievably high.
Writing about that time, is it something of a refuge in a way, though,
from
today's political world?
Absolutely, yes. You know, my husband and I joke about it because, he says, you know, you won't write about living people. And I keep saying, well, it's my day job, you know. This is much, it's much more soothing to write about dead people. But it's also true that it does give me a sense of comfort because I realize that, things were worse. I mean, people are always asking me, is this the most partisan time in our history? And the answer to that question is no, it's not. Now, the most partisan time was the 1850s, and that led to war. So it's not something that we want to repeat. But knowing our history, I think, does give you a much, much better sense of today and understanding what's going on today.
Final email here from Ray in Montague, California. He writes, I happened to be listening to Morning Edition when your little dog became part of the show. As a dog lover, I thought it was very entertaining, but you must have kept him out of the room for future broadcasts. I always enjoy listening to your insights. Good luck with your new book.
Well, my original dog, Abner, who was a Basset Hound, loved being on the radio. And he would find ways to be on the radio. He'd go to the room underneath the room that I was broadcasting in and set up a Basset howl. And he was just a radio dog. And he started showing up in the station's brochures around the country. It really sort of ticked me off, you know. I mean, what was this dog was getting famous all over the place, and all he was doing was howling. He wasn't doing any work. But my most recent dog, who is a very sweet chocolate lab, did have a little moan the other day, so I'm trying to keep her off the radio.
All right. The book is called Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies, from Cokie Roberts, a long career in journalism. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeff, great to be with you, and I enjoyed talking to you and your call.